This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Get 24/7 instant access to over 400 estate planning and administration e-lectures and more with a subscription to the MCLE Online Pass. Learn more at www.mcle.org/onlinepass. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
Thank you, Karen. My name is T. Michael Sullivan, but please call me Mike Sullivan. I'm going to be talking about handling some of the different things with the insolvent estates in two different parts. The first part, I'm going to go over a case study involving the federal priority statute. And then the third part, or the second part of my talk, I'm going to be going over how to deal with the claims and how to deal with the insolvent estate and some of the procedures. So the case I want to talk about today is the United States versus Robert Raetano. The personal representative, this was pre the Uniform Probate Code, so we're going to use the term executrix, and that is his wife, Marcy McNichol, or Marcy Raetano, and against her as well individually. I'm going to talk about both this case and the appeal to the case together. The appeal was basically that the lower court properly decided the case, but there are some interesting facts that came out in the appeal that didn't necessarily come out in the rest of the case. So the plaintiff here is the United States of America on behalf of the IRS. The defendants are the estate of Robert Raetano, like I said, Marcy McNichol, and both individually and executrix. And then on the appeal, it was Marcy individually. She did not appeal the decision and judgment against the estate. So procedurally, this case was brought in 2012 in the District of Court for the District of Massachusetts. There were some preliminary motions back and forth and some skirmishing, but ultimately they filed cross motions for a summary judgment. The important thing here is that in what hurt Marcy, I'm going to call her Marcy rather than McNichol, aka Raetano, so I'll just call her Marcy. So the thing that hurt her most here was that she never filed the proposed statement of facts, and she didn't challenge the statement of facts presented by the U.S. District Court, or by the United States of America, I'm sorry. So let's go over the facts of the case. Robert Raetano died July 25th, 2002. He left his wife, Marcy, and four minor children. At the time of his death, he had a significant tax liabilities totaling over $342,000. He had two significant assets in his estate. He owned a 50% share of a company that owned a fishing boat called the Makaira as its sole asset. And he owned 100% of the shares of another company with the fishing boat, the Sophia Gale. Just for informational purposes, the other 50% of the company that owned the Makaira was owned by his wife. He also had a Mercedes-Benz, which was returned to the lien holder, and $272.61 to his name. So shortly after he died, the first thing that occurred was Marcy transferred the shares that owned the Sophia Gale to herself. The shares were worth approximately $80,000. They got this information from her deposition. On April 11, 2003, not that far after, she transferred the Makaira to herself. The shares of this were worth about $107,500, but the boat was subject to liens in the amount of $61,562.37. We later find out that the reason why she transferred this to her is because she wanted to keep operating the businesses. The businesses were doing quite well and there was a lot of income, and so she transferred everything to her rather than taking it and selling it and bringing it part of the estate. So the IRS immediately notified Marcy of the tax liabilities that she had in October 27, 2003. These liabilities were for the tax years 2000, 2001, and 2002, but of course the filing for those is 2001, 2002, and 2003. The parties worked together over the years to try to make something happen and settle this issue, and then finally in 2008, Marcy said that she was no longer going to cooperate, and that's when the IRS informed her that she had violated the federal priority statute. It says in the appeal that it's likely that her intention was to try to duck the federal priority statute and the statute of limitations for the federal priority statute. So just going to talk about what the U.S. said in their motion and what Marcy said in hers. The U.S. said that there's no issues of material fact here and that they're entitled to judgment of matter of law. And so they said, here are the tax liabilities, here's what they total, Marcy isn't challenging this in any way, we're entitled to judgment. The second claim that they made was saying that Marcy was personally liable under the federal priority statute for distributing assets without paying the federal tax claims first. They said that she was liable for $125,937.63. They got this number by taking the value of the Sophia Gale plus the value of the Makaira minus the liens that were already on there. So in Marcy, basically, she didn't file any contested facts or anything like that. She didn't say that she didn't violate the statute. She didn't say that the numbers were inaccurate. Instead, she said that the family allowance and funeral administrative expenses would take priority over the claims of the United States. And she knew that once those were paid out, there wouldn't be any money left anyways. And so the United States wasn't entitled to anything. So let's talk about a little bit about the federal priority statute itself. I'm going to jump forward a couple slides here. The federal priority statute, which is 31 U.S. Code section 3713, says that the U.S. government shall be paid first when the amount in the estate is not enough to pay all debts and an executrix paying any part of the debt of the person of the estate before paying the claim is going to be liable to the extent of that payment. And so that's what the law itself says, but the Internal Revenue memos, Internal Revenue Code, and case law have kind of stretched out what that really means because the law itself seems rather harsh on its face. So generally, the law requires that the taxes are paid first. There are some exceptions, which we're going to talk about on the next slide. It says that the debts are going to be satisfied from the decedent's estate alone, and that it says if you transfer money outside of the estate without paying the government first, you're personally liable for everything that you transfer. So what are some of the exceptions? Some of the exceptions are the prior interest. So when they made that claim, for the $125,000 and change, they were taking into account the prior interest that was before any assessment or any tax was realized on the boat. So that's an example of the prior interest. They also said administrative expenses are going to be exceptions, and that's the cost and expense to collect and preserve the assets and the funeral expenses, but not the expenses of the last illness, so not the medical bills from the hospital or the ambulance bills or what have you. And then they also said that exempt is a family allowance, but it must be reasonable. And so I just want to reiterate here, we're talking about the federal law, which in some cases, this is why it's sort of a trap for the unwary here, in some cases it's it contradicts what some of the laws in Massachusetts are, and that's why it's so important to be aware of it. So the IRS has a special statute of limitations period. They actually have three. So if you read the code, they have a statute of limitations for assessment period, for the refund period, and for the collection period. We're not going to talk about the refund because we're not getting one in this case. But the assessment period. They have a general assessment period where an assessment must be made within 3 years after the return is filed. As I said earlier, we're talking about the tax years 2001 and 2002, but it's the year they were filed, so it extends it out to 2003. Once they show you that they've made that assessment, they then have 10 years to collect. And as I explained, we get a 2003, they notified her of the assessment, and they didn't actually file until 2012, so 9 years later. And that's why the court, the appeals court, sort of hinted that maybe Marcy was really trying to avoid the statute here. So in the case law, we've kind of broken down that there are actually elements to this case, which they went over in this case, both in the initial decision and again in the appellate decision. And so at the time of transfer, these are the elements. Number one, at the time of transfer, the debtor knew that the estate was insolvent or would be rendered insolvent by the transfer. The fiduciary actually did the transferring. Now, in this case, Marcy wasn't appointed when she did the first transfer, but she knew of the debt and she was in possession of the assets, so they considered her a fiduciary at that time. She was named executrix in the will, she just hadn't filed yet. And then finally, the third is that before making the transfer, she knew of the debt. So the estate would be rendered insolvent, she's the one who did it, and she knew of the debt beforehand. And so, the next slide, the issue, burden of proof. Basically, the issue was whether or not she was responsible for the tax liabilities and whether the facts show that she violated the federal priority statute. So Marcy had the burden of proof to show that there was a dispute over the taxes in count one or that she didn't violate the statute in count two. Excuse me. And she didn't contest them. She didn't contest count one, and the court basically said, well, it's uncontested here. The facts were going on the facts presented. You lose. And she didn't contest count two either in terms of the facts. She did say that, as I mentioned before in her cross motion for summary judgment, that their family allowance, funeral expenses, administrative expenses would take priority over the plaintiff's claim. And that's true. And the court, hinted, at least in the lower court, that yes, that probably would be true, but we're not going to decide that here because the facts are simple. You violated the statute, you transferred it out of your name, and you didn't go through the process of determining whether the estate was insolvent or not, or collecting the assets and selling it off for the estate. So Marcy moved for reconsideration, and the court denied it. So she ended up taking it to the appellate court. She appealed only the decision against her individually, again saying that exceptions to the law should be applied and that she shouldn't be personally liable. The court went through everything again, read everything de novo again, but came up with the same conclusion. We conclude that the statute says what it means, and it means what it says. And they kind of one of the last lines, and it said, in this case, all roads lead to Rome, which I found kind of humorous. So they affirmed the judgment of the lower court. So what were Marcy's options? What should she have done? Well, if she was going to go forward and open the estate and get herself appointed, she needed to collect the assets, she needed to do account, she needed to open a tax ID, get a tax ID number, open an estate account, and she needed to determine her family and spousal rights, as we talked about prior. She then needed to prioritize the claims, make any attempts to settle this claim with the IRS, which she may have done a little bit, but she gave up on when, as the court suggests, she was trying to beat the statute. She needs to then declare the estate insolvent if it is, and pay out the claims in accordance with the court order. And the federal priority statute says that the IRS will be paid first. After she did all that, she should formally close the estate and discharge her bond, and make sure that she's no longer that the estate's been closed officially, and she's no longer personal representative, or in the case of this pre-MUPC case, the executrix. All right, so now I'm going to talk about, let's see how much time I have left here. So now in the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to talk about handling the insolvent estates and dealing with creditors and the procedure. So as we talked about prior, as Karen mentioned and spoke about prior, there are claims that are made, and then there are potential claims and claims that aren't served upon the personal representative. So as discussed prior, if the claims haven't been made in the court and if they haven't beat the year to file suit, you can wait until the end of the claims period. You can also, if you do that though, I do suggest that you formally close the estate. Oftentimes we close the estate by a closing statement. Perhaps there's no creditors, there's no debt, there's two children, everybody agrees on everything, and then we close it by a closing statement. But the closing statement doesn't officially close the estate until 1 year has gone by after the date that you had filed it. You also really can't use a closing statement, in my opinion, if you have a bond. You need to get the court to formally discharge you and release the bond. So in any case with a claim, I usually recommend that we go through the formal petition for order of complete settlement and final account, file that, and have that get allowed. I just want to stress, too, that we're talking about state law with this. My bullet point number four on this next slide just reiterates that there's a little difference with the IRS. So let's say a formal claim is made, then what do you do? Well, you can challenge it. you can challenge it informally without going through the probate court by simply, you know, asking for an accounting. Sometimes we'll get a claim from MassHealth, and it'll be a large number, and we'll say, okay, you know, MassHealth, show me, give me proof, show me all the itemized time and expenses that were paid. It's kind of funny, they send it to you on a CD, which is sometimes difficult to get a machine these days that plays the CD, so you can open it up and open it up the file, but that's what they do. So you can go through that, you can debate back and forth, you could do that with a telephone bill, you can do that with whatever, debate back and forth and figure out if there's any legitimate claims here, and if there are, if you also figure out if there's any claims that aren't legitimate and go back and forth. Once you've done that and there are still some claims that you're not going to be able to settle and that maybe you don't think are just, you can challenge the claim by filing a motion to strike. Now, you may do this, they made the claim, they forgot or just let time go by and never actually sued. That's a good reason to file a motion to strike, that that the statute is up. And so you do a motion to strike, that'd get kicked out, and then you can formally close the estate. Or you might move to strike for other reasons. You want to just challenge the claim itself. You feel that it's unjust for whatever particular reason. Now, once you do the motion to strike, once you challenge these claims, it's the burden of the claimant to prove that they in fact have a claim. You say, no, motion to strike, I think this is bogus, then they have to prove why. That's not the case with the IRS. With the IRS, the personal representative is going to have the burden to prove that the claim is so it's kind of a reversal there. So the personal representative has to say, we can prove that we don't owe this money to the IRS. So that's something to keep in mind. So this next slide, I kind of stuck in here. It doesn't really fit necessarily so much, but I had to go somewhere. And that's a slide pertaining to the claim period for the Division of Medical Assistance. And here, as was said prior, that they have 4 months after the approval of the bond or 1 year after the date of death. And we'll go back on that 1 year after the date of death part in a minute. This is another option for them. But within the 4 months after approval of the bond, so you file your petition, you get a citation, you're supposed to serve that citation along with a copy of the petition and a copy of the death certificate by certified mail to DMA. The Division of Medical Assistance. You'll find that if there is a claim, they are very quick to respond and come back at you with the claim and file it with the court. You know, one of the reasons why you do this is there doesn't seem to be a great way for the Division of Medical Assistance to find out that someone has passed. So I think that's why it's kind of written in the law this way, that you have to send it to them certified mail and let them know so they can make their claim. So, let's talk about you have some claims and you think you can settle the claims. Maybe there's the creditor period's expired. There's one claim left. That claim could potentially make the estate insolvent. It's, you know, maybe they've started suit. And so you want to see if you can settle this claim. Oftentimes, MassHealth is actually pretty good about settling claims. Let's say all you had in the estate was a house. You didn't realize there was a MassHealth claim out there. You opened up the estate and it was time to sell the house. So MassHealth over the years I found has been great about, you know, we'll do the work, we'll list the house, we'll prepare it for sale, we'll get it sold, and then we'll come back to MassHealth with the purchase and sale agreement and we'll explain this is what the family allowance was, this is what the spousal share was, these were the costs of the administration, and we can usually work out a deal to make sure that gets paid, the attorneys get paid, and MassHealth will do, they'll sort of sign a conditional release. You can give that to the closing attorney on the other side so they know that MassHealth is going to withdraw a lien if they have it or withdraw a claim with the probate court and get it done that way. It's important to have good relations with MassHealth and good relations to your caseworker, especially in a case like this, because as you know, if the closing gets bumped for whatever reason, perhaps there's adjustments that are going to be made on stuff like taxes. And so, you know, you need MassHealth to be able to respond to that quickly and give you a new release if need be. If it's not a MassHealth claim and you are able to settle it, you may want to think about doing a petition for approval of a compromise. So that's sort of the next slide. The next slide discusses this. It's got all the check marks to show and the petition itself, and then it has that other section. In the other section, you can elaborate more. Sometimes I say see attached, and I have a memorandum supporting the petition to explain the case a little bit more. But that's basically the next couple slides. Slide number 25, the decree and order of compromise. I think the only thing I really wanted to talk about here is it's really important on your decrees that you're presenting to the court to make sure that you have in there exactly what you want it to say. And it kind of sounds silly in a way that I'm saying this, but you're giving the court, you're giving the judge your proposed decree and order. If the judge agrees, she hears your argument, he is just going to sign off on that in most cases in front of you and hand it back to you. Boom, you have your decree and order. You can likely get it the same day, especially with the online, with the immediate docketing in some of the courts. But she or he is likely not going to add additional language in there. So make sure that your proposed decree and order says exactly what you want it to say. If something's supposed to happen within 30 days, make sure it says within 30 days in the decree and order. The judge can always change it if she finds that or feels that 30 days is too little time, but you need to make sure that everything you want is in that decree and order. So you've tried all these things. You've tried to settle your claims. You've tried to knock them out by the statute of limitation. You tried to see if they just would go away, and they haven't. So if any time you realize that either before the statute or after, you realize that the estate is going to become insolvent, you must file a representation of insolvency. So on that representation, it's going to say the total of all debts with names and addresses of the claimants, the amount of exempt property that you can claim in the family allowance, and the cost of administration, including future costs. Now, here is where you have to be very careful. You may have to go through this whole proceeding. It could take more than one day. Who knows if you have more than one claimant. And then you might want to do a petition for order of complete settlement or somehow get your bond discharged at the end. So when you're estimating this cost, these future costs, be sure to have a good cushion for yourself as the attorney if you expect to get paid. And as Karen said prior, judges love to cut this fee in half. So, or even, you know, cut it in some way, shape, or form. So, I wouldn't go crazy in your over-exaggeration, but I would make sure you have a pretty good cushion there. And to Karen's point as well, it's really important to keep really good records of what you're billing for, why you're billing for it, and keep a really good log. A lot of you, I'm sure, use different programs to keep track of your time, but that's really important when it comes, you know, that you have to justify what your fees were. Also in that representation of insolvency, you're going to see a spot for the funeral expenses, the dates, the debts and taxes federally, expenses of last illness, debts for taxes of the Commonwealth, debts due to DMA, and then everything else. So here's the form. As you can see, it explains on there the spots to put everything in there. It's got that please explain the reason under number two. For any disputed debts. So again, I would file a memorandum to kind of supplement this. Sometimes these forms are great, but sometimes there's not enough room to really say what you have to say. And then that's page two. Excuse me one second. All right, so you've done that. You've filed your representation of insolvency, and then you need to ask for a hearing date so that everyone has an opportunity to present their claims. After that, you are going to send out a copy of the representation of insolvency to all the claimants and a notice of hearing. No publication is required on this, which is great, hopefully, because you've listed everybody in your list of claimants, and hopefully nobody else pops up afterwards. The personal representative then must file with the court an affidavit of notice saying, I sent out the notice of hearing, I sent out the representation of insolvency. These are court forms. It's not a simple certificate of service, or it's not a simple notice of hearing that you might draft yourself. At the hearing, everyone can contest their claims. You can go back and forth on a particular claims. If a claimant fails to show for any particular reason, their claim can be knocked out automatically, but they will have 30 days to appeal any final judgment. So here, the next slide, slide 30, has got the affidavit of insolvency. You see it's a simple form, but just make sure you're using the court forms. And then you have your hearing, and then the court determines that the estate doesn't have enough funds to pay all the claims, and they issue their decree and order of insolvency. Once the decree and order has entered, the personal representative is then going to pay out in accordance with the priority statute. And as I said, if their claim is not allowed, they have 30 days to appeal. Here, I have the decree and order of insolvency. So what I would recommend, it says name a creditor amount. I would recommend putting in, the judges don't like to, like I said, do this. Usually you file your proposed decree in order. So I would recommend putting in all the creditors and all the amounts and then asking the judge to cross out the particular amount or the particular creditor if someone doesn't show or their claim isn't been proved. I like to do it this way because I want to have something that the judge can sign right away that I can take with me right away. And I don't want any confusion. I want my decree in order to be very clear. So I don't have a ton of time left, but I want to talk a little bit about what to do if you've gotten yourself in this situation and you don't want to be part of this situation any longer and you want to get out. You've been appointed, perhaps you want to get out. So what about a public administrator? A public administrator, there's usually 2, 3, sometimes 4 per county. They're appointed by the governor, and they basically will administer estates when there's no surviving spouse, no heirs in the Commonwealth, no one found, and no one steps up. Sometimes a city or town will hire a public administrator to sell a piece of property. There seem to be no heirs or anything like that, but there's now taxes, property taxes that are building. And so sometimes a public administrator will be appointed, sell the property at auction, pay off the debts to the town, and then there will be money left in the estate. Possibly. But you can use a public administrator when all others with priority have declined to serve and they've nominated you. So how's that going to work? So your personal representative wants to resign. They file a statement of resignation, which becomes effective after approval by the court. So they file this statement. They give it to every known interested party 15 days before they finalize it. The court takes it in, but it's not going to be allowed until a successor personal representative has been appointed. So as sort of a practice tip, what you're going to want to do is simultaneously file the petition for successor, the resignation, the assents, the military affidavits, have that bond ready. If it's sureties, have the successor, apply, make sure they get their sureties ahead of time, or at least they're ready to have their sureties ahead of time. And then possibly file a motion to waive publication. You've already gone through the process of publishing that the person had passed away and the estate was being opened. So I like to try to avoid that extra cost if I can. So the statement of resignation, pretty simple, says right on there that you got to give the 15 days notice, you file that, and then the assent. So the assent to the resignation, pretty simple. You're going to check the top box, assent and waiver of notice. You're going to check section 1, I hereby assent to the resignation, sign it, and move forward. It's a little less obvious what to do on the petition for successor. Oftentimes this form gets confused, and so you want to make sure you fill it out correctly. So if you have priority and you're getting rid of your priority, you're going to want to make sure you check the assent and waiver of notice, the renunciation, nomination, and then whether or not you waive sureties. You do this by filling out section B. A lot of people want to fill out section C. It's just not the correct section. So there are directions to this form online. Make sure you move slowly. So we're pretty much out of time here. I do have the next couple of slides showing you what the forms look like, what the decree and order looks like. But the last slide, just in summary, what could Marcy have done? The first thing that's always advisable is to hire an attorney that specializes in administrating estates. And make sure you have someone competent to advise that person. She should have done a proper accounting. She should have involved the court every step of the way. And if it was too much for her, she could have sought to find a public administrator or someone else to act on her behalf. Most cases don't have federal tax issues like it did with Marcy's case, but you should be very wary if the IRS is involved. So I think we're about out of time, Karen.